ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello. Today, it's a conversation we recorded under the trees at the Pioneer Women's Memorial Garden at the recent Adelaide Writers' Week. My guest is the American author Jonathan Rosen. In his new book, The Best Minds, Jonathan tells the story of his childhood friend, Michael Lauder. The two met as 10-year-olds. They were neighbourhood kids who played basketball together, walked to school together, went to the same parties as teenagers, and then both headed off to Yale University. But in their 20s, Michael's path diverged sharply from Jonathan's. He ended up in a locked psychiatric ward, and the future seemed bleak. But after a surprising academic rebirth, there was a profile in the New York Times, followed by a big book deal and the commissioning of a Hollywood movie with Leonardo DiCaprio tapped to play Michael. It all looked to be a great arc of redemption, but tragically, it ended somewhere very different. Michael's story includes some very disturbing elements, so do listen with care. But Jonathan is a keen bird watcher, and there's a surprise appearance by a kookaburra in this recording to enliven things, so listen out for that. Let's go now to Jonathan Rosen at Adelaide Writers' Week. Let's start at the beginning, Jonathan. When did you first set eyes on Michael?
Well, 1973. My family moved to a suburb of New York City called New Rochelle, and we lived on a very short street, one block long, and Michael lived at the bottom of it, and I lived at the top of it. And the day after, I think, if not the very day we moved in, he wandered up the street to greet me, because I was standing in the street contemplating the house and the trash left by the former owners.
And what did he look like?
He was very tall. I was quite tall, too. He was really only an inch or two taller than me, but his nickname was Big because he looked tall, and he walked with a kind of lilting step so that in addition to being called Big, he was called Toes. And he was a much better basketball player than I was. But he also looked, there was something almost elderly about him at the same time. He had tinted glasses, which people didn't usually have. Aviators, which we all wore. But there was something almost geriatric, as if he was living backwards. And he was a very precocious kid. And he somehow looked precocious in addition to being precocious.
And why had your parents moved to New Rochelle? What drew them to that town?
Well, we'd been living in Boston because my father was teaching there. Moved back to the orbit of New York City, where both my parents had lived for many years. For my mother, New York City was the epicenter of the universe. New Rochelle was a compromise, but she had a very good friend, Cynthia Ozick, who was a wonderful writer. And we moved there partly because she wanted to live in a neighborhood where her friend, the writer, lived. My mother was also a writer. And I think that they just thought this is the right place to raise kids. And in fact, as Cynthia later wrote me, they assumed I would meet someone like Michael, as I did.
So you and Michael's families lived on the same street. How similar were things inside your houses?
Well, in certain ways, we seemed like we were living perfectly parallel lives. My father was a college professor. Michael's father was a college professor. But my father, who taught German literature, was a refugee from Vienna who had fled as a child. Michael's father had grown up in Brooklyn, wore a leather bomber jacket. My dad had these very tweedy jackets. Michael's father was kind of outward. He also walked like Michael on his toes and came right at you. My father used to back away when Michael's father would talk to us. And Michael had three brothers. I was one of three brothers. I had a sister. So when my sister and I played Monopoly, we let each other buy the properties we liked. In Michael's family, it was just a Darwinian, you know, scrimmage for survival, which I loved because they were always jumping on each other. And if you didn't eat fast, there was no food. They labeled their food in the refrigerator. And so it was something I didn't get, whereas he loved coming to our house and would often sit in the garden when I would come back from somewhere. He would be there talking to my mother when she was gardening or my sister when she was doing homework. He liked the peace.
In the world you grew up in, what kind of value was put on your intellect, on your brains?
Too much value. It was simply assumed that being smart was not just your job, but that it was somehow going to be your salvation in a way we never needed to even understand. But we both came from homes where there were many books. The expectation was that you would think your way into the future and that we would just blast off in our own craniums, you know, and it wasn't that you would make the world better with your intelligence. Being smart was the goal. It would set you apart. And later, of course, that notion came to haunt me, partly because Michael's brilliance was what set him apart, but it's also what allowed people to discount his illness. He himself used to say, "I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid." I was dyslexic, so I was faking it. Michael had a photographic memory and read incredibly fast. And it was being smart, to my mind, at the expense of the kind of equality that the soul bestows on you. And that became a problem, too, because to not be smart was to be not normal, but to be an outcast.
Did that mean that things were competitive between you and this dear friend?
We were very competitive. Michael was much more overtly competitive because he wasn't embarrassed about being competitive, which I envied. I was stealthily competitive, also because we would go book shopping together. My father would take us into the city. There was a vast store, became Barnes & Noble, but at the time it was just a used bookstore, and we would just load up our carts. But Michael would start reading online to pay for the books, which were always like a quarter. I wouldn't, but I had chosen only classics because I wasn't going to read them anyway. I was just, they were tokens of future accomplishment. And so he would tell me the plots of the books he read, and I kind of got an education that way.
So what were some of the incidents that marked your friendship as teenagers, as it changed from perhaps that easier kind of physical proximity of 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds? When you were 15, 16 in high school, what stands out?
The first week of high school, I always used to say we were beaten up by a big gang of kids, but Michael got away.
Ran away.
Not as he told it. He shook himself free and ran, which is true. It's not like if I had not immediately gone down and gotten stomped, I would have stayed and fought beside him. But it was shameful for both of us for different reasons. I was ashamed that I was so unaware of these guys who were so clearly waiting to beat us up, not because they knew us, but just because it was a slow afternoon in our very big high school. I was jealous of him for having what he would have called the street smarts. And of course, he felt, without my realizing it, ashamed that he had run. He ran and then turned and watched. I mean, I'm sure it was all over very quickly, but for me, it was a long moment. And that kind of marked an aspect of my high school time and his. We never really talked about it. And then we both wanted to be the editor-in-chief of the paper. And when we were asked by the man who, the faculty advisor of the paper, went privately, he said to me, if Michael was the editor, would you stay on and help him be assistant, be managing editor? I said, of course. But when he asked Michael privately, Michael said, no, I could not. I couldn't. And then he told me that as we walked home that day.
Michael told you?
He told me, and I said, well, I suggested we could work together and both be editors. And he said, no, that would be wrong. He saw himself as the person who ought to be running it. And whether that was already an early sign of his enormous self-confidence shading into a kind of grandiosity that later was stretched into something even more extreme, I don't know. But these elements kind of later figured in my reconfiguration of our friendship and of who he was and who I was, by the way.
You write in the book that madness was in the air when you and Michael were growing up in the 1970s. What do you mean?
Well, we were both born in 1963, which technically is the very end of the baby boom. We got there in time to split the bill, but we missed the feast. You know, it was the 60s. We were obsessed with the 60s. If only we could have gone to Woodstock. But later, of course, I came to discover how the people formed in that world decided to change the world according to its principles, including the mental health care system. And so it wasn't just the validation of madness as a way of, you know, freeing your mind, let's say, but all the touchstones. The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest became a movie. It had been a novel in the 70s, and it was the hero of the movie, who's in a psychiatric hospital, is the only person there who isn't, in fact, mentally ill. He's just a victim of circumstances. And so we didn't know that R.D. Lang, the Scottish psychiatrist, had said that in a mad world, only psychosis is the only form of sanity. But those values were represented all the time, whether you were listening to Still Crazy After All These Years or anything else in a way that talked about mind expansion. I mean, one of the things I learned only after the fact was already in the 50s, LSD was introduced, given to psychiatrists to distribute, and so was antipsychotic medication. And so in one hand, they had a medication that suppressed hallucinations and delusions, and in the other hand, they had a medication or a substance that induced it. And the culture immediately decided that hallucinations were mind-expanding, expanding, more mind. And therefore, the people who naturally experience those things must be priests or mystics. And so how could you ever then imagine there was a state of unreality that might require an intervention? And so that was only in the 50s. By the 60s, though, it had taken on a life of its own and was just, absorbed into the culture. No one wanted to be conventional. The secret source of shame I discovered later, writing the book, for a lot of the kids my age was if you didn't do drugs. And you wouldn't want to share that, for example.
And R.D. Lang, who you mentioned, of course, had those ideas that in an insane world, the sane people are the ones in the asylum. And so psychiatry itself was having a really strong anti-psychiatry moment in the 70s.
It was. And so it was turned against itself in a way. And that made it enormously, enormously difficult. Psychoanalysis was still loomed large. Both my parents had been in analysis. It was the language you spoke. But Freud did not treat people with psychotic disorders. Instead, he spoke of what he called the psychopathology of everyday life. If everyday life is psychopathology, then it's great if you're a psychoanalyst because you can treat them well and you could get out of those big asylums. Everyone was suffering from a form of disorder all on a continuum, whether it was schizophrenia or neurosis, all caused by childhood repression. But the people they borrowed the idea of illness from were the most intractably sick. And so that was already an inversion of that it took me years to understand because I was so steeped in the language of psychoanalysis.
As a teenager, Michael started hanging out at the house of one of your friends from school whose parents were psychiatrists. What were things like at the Ferber house?
I was never invited to those parties, but by Michael's telling, they were where it was like the 60s in one attic. And what was extraordinary about it was that, first of all, it was a very grand house. It was really a mansion, which had been built by D.W. Griffith, the silent movie maker. There was a time when Westchester was the center of Hollywood, before there was Hollywood. And Michael called it the Gatsby House, which was perfect, really, because we wanted to be F. Scott Fitzgerald and we wanted to be Gatsby at the same time. We both wanted to be writers. There were drugs, there was talk all night, and it was owned by psychiatrists who were very instrumental in the community psychiatry movement until the father, who was a very eminent family psychiatrist, became a follower of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who sometimes called the sex guru, and went off to India. He wore orange. First, he had meditated in the attic and said goodbye to his family. And at a certain point, Michael moved into that attic. But meanwhile, the Ferber house was really just kind of it was the place of Gatsby-esque parties.
Despite the wild times in that attic at the Ferber house, Michael got into Yale University, as did you. And so for the ninth year in a row, you headed off to the same school. Did you move in the same circles at Yale?
No. And that was another moment when the summer before college, I remember, we were sitting on my family's patio And I thought I'd finally caught up. I was the last person to get my license. Someone had lent me a very cool, I thought, 1968 Volvo, a professor from Berkeley. It didn't have brakes, it turned out, but it, nevertheless, I had a car, whereas Michael had this little tiny Fiat that he used to always work on. It didn't go anywhere, but he was always fixing the engine. He said to me suddenly, "I don't think we'll see much of each other." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "You're too slow." We didn't see all that much of each other. And he was fast. I always felt like the tortoise to his hare, and he graduated with highest honors in 3 years. I needed every minute of my four.
He announced to you that he'd decided to become rich, as though this was just something you could elect to do. How did he plan on making this happen?
Well, it was just the beginning of what was called management consulting, or not the very beginning, but partly the beginning, where people got paid enormous amounts of money to be able, with a tremendous amount of confidence, to persuade people who'd been in business for 20 years that they were doing it all wrong, which was made for Michael. He was recruited, he was interviewed multiple times, and he went to work for a place called Bain. And he felt it was selling out because his father, like my father, had a kind of been socialists and often derided aspects of capitalist culture. Nevertheless, his goal was to make enough money in 10 years so that he could retire and be a writer. And so that was the 10-year plan.
So his life must have looked like it was on this upward trajectory. Were you envious?
I was envious, but I was often envious of the very things that people didn't like about him. He was arrogant, and it put people off, but I admired his ability to say he was going to do something without feeling that that would therefore doom him to a shameful failure, which was much more the way in my own home for some reason, and partly because I'd had learning disabilities. I never was sure if I could do it, but also it was, you know, he even loved this movie Billy Jack, where the hero would say to some huge guy, "I'm going to take my right foot and I'm going to kick you on the left side of your face and you're going to fall over so fast," and then he would do it, you know, and he loved that because it was as if the resistance is futile, and that's what he was going to do.
So what were you doing while he was off making money in fancy suits?
I was in graduate school at Berkeley, California, taking a second crack at adolescence because I felt I'd missed it the first time around. And because I got a fellowship and because I didn't have to pay off my college loans if I was still a graduate student, and because that's where the professor who gave me the car, who had driven from Berkeley to New York in it with his beautiful wife, had gone. And that's what I was doing. I went to study English literature.
Michael's plan was to give 10 years of his life to making money in this management consultancy world, but he left after only 1 year. He wanted to write fiction and he moved back to New Rochelle. You know, he seemed to have always been so easily brilliant at anything he turned his hand to. But what were his stories like? What was his writing like?
Well, it's interesting. The children of the psychiatrists who owned the Gatsby House, I've become friends with, especially the daughter, and they were enormously helpful to me, used to say to each other, "He can do anything he wants except write a story." But I didn't know that I thought that was true. He gave me his stories. The thing is, he left Bain after a year because he was already becoming delusional. He became intensely paranoid. He would see things. Suddenly the secretary had fangs or bloody clawed hands. And he was afraid that if he quit, they would kill him because they'd invested too much in him. But if he invented a job that was so important that they would, then would they understand why he was leaving, because it would pay him more. So he put a lot of energy into creating a second imaginary job. But I didn't know that's why he left. I thought he left to be a writer. And impatient as always, he just turned his 10-year plan to a 1-year plan and was living in the attic writing stories. And he gave me his stories at one point, and they were very dark and they were hallucinogenic almost. But Michael used to tell me stories by science fiction writers, Philip K. Dick and Ray Bradbury, and they often had that semi-hallucinated quality, but I was deeply troubled by the stories, but I didn't know if that's because I admired them, their boldness so much, or if because there was some, and I didn't take myself as the touchstone as I took him or not. So that was an aspect of it.
So you hadn't been aware about the sort of changes or developments in Michael's inner mental state until you got a phone call from your parents. And what did they tell you about Michael?
Yeah, so my parents both called, which was unusual, unless it was my birthday, which had already passed, to say that Michael was in the hospital and that he was in a locked ward and that he'd had a psychotic break. I didn't know what any of those things meant. My father left out the word psychotic. He just kept saying he had a break, and I thought, was he in a car accident? But only then did I understand. I called Michael's father. We had a conversation. He had never forgiven my father for my becoming editor of the newspaper. He told my father that I should resign in favor of Michael. But I called him, and it was clear something terrible had happened. I went bird watching the other day, and this is the most wonderful thing I can imagine. So, you know, I can't tell you what it is, but I know it's a bird I never saw before.
Kookaburra.
That's a kookaburra. Oh, my gosh, that's what I wanted to see. I've been laughed at by a kookaburra. Oh, even here I get to, you know, the past isn't another country, but Australia is, and I can only see it here. Okay.
Dramatic moment of the first great dramatic moment of this story where your friend is in a locked ward,
yes,
and you're talking to his father.
Yes, and here I am telling jokes. There we go. Life is mysterious. So I didn't know what it meant, but I understood talking to his father that something terrible had happened. And indeed, the stories I learned was that Michael thought his own parents were Nazi replicas of his actual parents, that they had killed his actual parents and taken their place. And he had begun patrolling the house with a kitchen knife. And he was so terrified that he felt he needed to arm himself to keep himself safe. And in the end, his mother had called the police, and he was now in a locked ward. And then I called Michael and spoke to him. I had no idea what that would be like or what it would mean. And then I went to see him. And it was a devastation because it was so clear that he had been so fully denatured by something physical. But at the same time, he was by then medicated and had at least one foot back in reality. But I would only add that to make it all the more powerful and strange, I was still a graduate student, and in those days, although I was studying literature, everybody had to read Foucault's Madness and Civilization and other books like it, influenced by or that ran parallel to R.D. Lang. And Foucault's idea is that madness is a social construct. It's merely something invented by the state to identify anyone who's different and to lock them away. And it took me about 30 seconds, let's say, with Michael to understand that he was not suffering from a social construct, that he was suffering from an illness, and that it was a life-changing one.
Michael spent 8 months in that locked ward and was given a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And he then moved into a rundown apartment where he was living with a group of other released patients. He had no money, no real job prospects. A caseworker suggested he apply for a job as a cashier at Macy's. What did Michael do instead?
Very characteristically, he went to Yale Law School. And at the time, that made perfect sense to all of us, because just as your brain was going to be your rocket ship and you would get in it and fly away, it made sense that he would think his way out of his predicament, even though it was his mind that was afflicted. And because of the way he told the story, why would I work at Macy's when I can be a Yale law student, which is also what his father said. And I need a parenthesis here in a way to say that everything that seemed terrible to me then, I understood differently later. For example, 8 months in a locked ward seemed like a prison sentence. He was very lucky at that time to spend as long as that in a hospital where they could at least tinker with the medication, that imperfect as it was and imprecise as the methods were, he could once again start to reclaim certain things. And so, in a way, what seemed like the worst imaginable thing, he was literally behind a locked door, was not a prison sentence, and that most people were hospitalized and released almost immediately because all the laws had changed and because there were no places to go anymore. The same thing was true with what he presented as his choice. Really, what he was told was that he needed to do something slow and small while he recovered his functioning as fully as he could. And by the way, I was also quite ashamed to discover how we all just universally agreed that working at Macy's was somehow like a doom instead of a perfectly normal, ordinary thing to do to be part of the world. But we were never going to simply be part of the world. So all of those things took a very long time to dawn on me. And when he said he was going to Yale Law School, because he'd applied before he became ill, he got in while he was in the hospital. And then when he was in his halfway house, he simply enrolled at Yale Law School.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanowski. Find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Was he open with his professors about his diagnosis and his time in the hospital?
He was open with his professors. He did not tell his fellow students, who all had a sense of his brilliance, but who also understood he couldn't do the work, and who very movingly took things on for him. They typed for him. They would make sure he got to class. They would help him do his work. But still, his sense of brilliance, his aura of genius, was still intact. His professors were absolutely fascinated by his illness. Talking to them later, it was quite a reckoning in a sense. They knew he couldn't do the work either, but they had clerked for the very judges who had changed the laws of institutionalization, and they were steeped in psychoanalysis also. They had no actual experience with psychosis, and so for them, this was, in a sense, just part of the fulfillment of what the work they had begun. They were wonderfully active in the civil rights movement, and they had seen the rights of people who were severely ill as just an extension of that. So tearing down the walls of the asylum were like, you know, integration. You were tearing down ghetto walls. And they never really stopped to wonder about his inner reality. And so they were fascinated and almost excited in a way by it. And it was a point of pride to accommodate him. They were ruthlessly harsh with people who seemed mediocre, who were perfectly fine. But he was included in this, in their own sense of themselves, and they were people who had crashed the gates in the earliest days of the meritocracy. They were Jewish men at this point of a certain age who had thought their way into these halls that had excluded them by being really good at the tests that got them there. And in a sense, they thought of it almost more like they'd been knighted and could knight someone else.
Michael referred to Yale Law School as America's most supportive mental health care facility, which I guess is what you're suggesting here in the terms of the support that he got from students and from professors. Was he still suffering hallucinations and delusions of the kind that had led to him being put in that psychiatric ward in the first place?
He was. And in fact, he told... This is what is so complicated about it. First of all, it was an extraordinary mental health care facility. The asylum as an idea remains essential. The places that we would call asylums had become dreadful. But Yale, here was a walled-in enclosure with green fields that was safe. and that gave him time, which is also what an asylum gives you and that the modern world never gives you, or it seemed to be giving him time. But he was actively hallucinating, but he was medicated enough to be able to tell his professors about it, so they all knew the story, as he told it, that every morning when he woke up, his bed was on fire. And he would call his father, and his father would talk him through the flames. His father would say, put out one arm. Is it burning? No. Now put the other hand in the fire. Is it hot? No. Now put your foot on the floor, even though Michael saw the floor engulfed in flames. And gradually, he would talk him out of bed. Now, every one of his professors was told this story. They told that story to each other, and they all told it to me. Michael was a wonderful storyteller. It doesn't mean it wasn't true, but it was the perfect, it was the story they wanted to hear. It was a father, and they were there in loco parentis, talking his son through psychosis with the power of words, which is kind of like what psychoanalysis is about, so he could function, even though sometimes he had to leave class because he thought it was on fire. And once he told the dean, I saw you this morning at the foot of my bed in flames, and I thought you were the devil. And what was amazing is that the dean's daughter was training to be a psychiatrist. I knew her. She'd gone to Yale a year behind me. At that time, she was training to be a street psychiatrist, so her patients slept under bridges. They were psychotic. And she said to her father, who was a very eminent professor, scholar, later a judge, Dad, you have no idea what you're talking about.
As well as these supportive friends that Michael had, he found a loving girlfriend, Carrie. What did she do for work?
She was a computer scientist, and she helped bring computers to underserved communities that had lousy schools. She was very good at it.
So it seemed then that Michael was sort of putting his life back together in a quite astonishingly successful way. And in November 1995, the New York Times published a big article on him with a photograph of him at Yale Law School. What was the story? What was the argument made in that profile piece?
The story was a brilliant young man with schizophrenia had triumphed over his illness. That's how the dean, who got the last word in the article, put it. He has struggled with his illness and triumphed over it. It was about how, when he was applying for jobs, they would ask him if he ever became violent. And the tenor of the story, which was entirely filtered through Michael's awareness of himself and his illness, was that stigma and discrimination were the reasons he wasn't given a shot. He described being asked if he ever became violent as a hateful stereotype. And it is a hateful stereotype. The awkwardness for me reading it was that I knew he had patrolled his house with a kitchen knife, and that it wasn't so much because he was violent as because if you think your parents are Nazi simulacra of real parents, then it is logical in a way to grab a knife. And that was part of it. So he was, and also, he had stayed 2 extra years, and I never knew this at the time. He told me he had stayed 2 extra years. They created a fellowship for him because I am so brilliant, is how he described it to me, which I saw no reason to question. As I later learned, they had created a fellowship for him because they wanted to give him time because they understood that he could not, in fact, go out and compete. And so what was so confusing for me when I discovered this was that their accommodation of him wasn't something they shared with him. So for him, it was a confirmation of his brilliance. And for them, it was an act of kindness that they were bestowing on him. But he already had trouble interpreting reality. Mm-hmm. And they were widening the gulf at the very moment they thought they were narrowing it for him.
How did his life change then after the publication of that New York Times profile? What happened?
It was completely transformed. He did not get hired to be a law professor, but he got called by Hollywood, and he got called by the publishing world. And he sold his story to be a memoir to a publisher for $500,000 or $600,000, and to Ron Howard to be a movie for $1 point something million. And so even though his 1- and 10-year plan to become a writer had been thwarted by his illness in a, one more of many inversions or paradoxes, the thing that had prevented him from doing that became the very thing that enticed Hollywood and the publishing world, attracted them to him, because he was going to tell the story of overcoming his illness and sort of live up to the profile that the Times had written. With the headline, the title was something like "A Brilliant Schizophrenic Encumbered by an Invisible Wheelchair," because the dean had spoken of building invisible ramps the way you would if someone were in a wheelchair. As the implication is that he was encumbered by the wheelchair, that the accommodation encumbered him, not the illness. And that confusion was unnoticed by me, among others. I just thought, oh, my God, because I was writing stories, too. The hair wins again.
I guess if, as you said, the 1970s had one flew over the cuckoo's nest, by the 1990s there was this ideal of mental illness, of this kind of mental illness, as being able to be taken back as a redemption story, and he was going to be the poster boy with Leonardo DiCaprio for a while.
Leonardo DiCaprio initially. He was very young, and this was going to be the great movie. And he was very interested in, fact, the guy who was wrote the screenplay enticed him by getting a sound man to record horrible noises of car crashes and screams. And at the meeting, he put the headphones on Leonardo DiCaprio and said, just keep listening to this while you talk to us, and that will be the challenge you'll have as an actor, to have all of this going on. And as this screenwriter said to me, and young actors love that. They love to play characters who are overcoming something. But in the end, Brad Pitt was going to do it. And so Brad Pitt was going to play him.
So Michael and his girlfriend Carrie moved to Hastings, a little town close to New Rochelle, with the intention for him to write his memoir. How isolated was he there? He'd gone from, as you describe, a very supportive, closed community at Yale. What was life like for Michael in Hastings?
If you made a list of all the things that would be terrible to do if you were recovering from severe illness, he fulfilled almost all of them. He was alone a lot of the time because Carrie worked in the city. He was being asked to make ordered sense of the worst thing that had ever happened to him, which continued to afflict him. And the stakes had been raised so high that he was determined to do it because the Hollywood movie was going on without him. In other words, although it was supposed to be based on his own memoir, the screenwriter wrote it anyway. They had a big file on him, which can't have been great for his paranoia. And they met with him so they could learn what he was like. And then they simply knew what they were writing. They were writing the story of a young man with terrible setbacks who ultimately triumphs. And he kept saying to me that his own written version would redeem the version that Hollywood was going to tell. So it was the old dream, but it was also the desire to be the master of his own story. And he couldn't tell that story, not only because it wasn't his story, because in a sense, the Times had intuited the story that Hollywood was going to tell, and Michael was then being told his own story by Hollywood. And so it wasn't tellable, but also simply because he was not able yet to function in that way. And so it was an impossible, lonely task. And things got worse. And meanwhile, by the way, the psychiatrists who cared for him, the people from the House of Psychiatry, all thought everything that happened to him was great. They thought Yale Law School was going to be the best thing that could happen to him. They thought being in this relationship was going to be great for him. They didn't think it was necessarily great for Carrie. And they thought that the movie was going to be great for him, except for one Cassandra-like woman who worked with families of people with schizophrenia and severe psychiatric disorders, and who understood how even good things are disruptive elements in a life that needs to recapture calm and measured sense of just equilibrium.
Were you in much contact with him Jonathan?
I was not in a great deal of contact. We did speak. We would occasionally get together. We had drifted even before he became ill. The things that had happened, the running away, the telling me I was too slow, the quitting the paper when I became the editor, as he did. Somehow, as I became happier and no longer measured myself either against him or with him or through him, I suddenly didn't feel connected that way. But when he became sick, I recognized how deeply we were connected in an almost sibling way. It was not about liking or disliking or even, it was just something almost deeper than friendship. And I'd assumed our fates were entwined for so long, not even assumed, felt, known. And we both felt that, actually. And so we did talk to each other. He would call sometimes when things went terribly wrong, but he would bury the bad news. And so it took only after we got off the phone, only after he had said, I have to go now, I'm having thoughts I shouldn't have, did I later think, that was not a good thing to say. And did I even know what that meant? And the answer, of course, was that I did not.
How did you hear what happened?
My mother called and told me not to go home. And that was because, as she said, Michael had hurt Carrie. She didn't tell me what that meant. I wasn't sure she knew. She had heard from someone in the neighborhood who had heard from Michael's mother. And I didn't know why I shouldn't go home, but she had a fear that he would find me. And he was then missing. But then Hurt Carrie was quickly updated to he had killed her. And 3 years after that New York Times profile, he was on the front page of the New York Post, the Murdoch tabloid, under a single word headline, psycho. So big that there wasn't even room for an exclamation point. And suddenly there he was, having killed his, as it turned out, pregnant fiance, and fled to Cornell University, where both of us had received a fellowship when we were 16. And I knew immediately that he had, or I felt I knew, that he had fled somehow to his childhood or adolescence when his mind was his friend and not his enemy. And he was then arrested and brought back in chains. And that was then the picture the next day, also on the cover, of Michael shackled, looking indeed wild-eyed, looking like the cartoonish headlines and portraits of him.
It's been an extraordinarily shocking thing for you to hear, at once so close and so distant to that story. What sort of state were you in the early days after hearing what Michael had done?
I kept waking up with the sense that I myself had done something terrible, that something terrible had both happened to me and that I had done it. And somehow some reporters had gotten hold of his address book. So I was called by Time magazine, a number of us were, and I kept saying, no, I have nothing to say. And I felt, you know, like Peter, denying. I mean, I just said, well, I don't know, but I didn't know. I didn't know what it meant at all. I wasn't even sure. I kept thinking he had been killed, and not that he had killed someone, but also maybe that I had, and I had horrific dreams. And it carried me back, not to childhood, but to some primal moment. At the time, I felt like it was my turn to run away. Mm.
He was found unfit to stand trial and was eventually sent to a secure psychiatric facility in the Hudson Valley, which is where he's lived for the last 25 years. Yeah. Despite this connection, this long history, you didn't go and visit him for a long time. Why not?
Probably fear. Probably uncertainty. I would meet his mother occasionally. When my father died, she came to Shiva, which is the gathering afterwards, gave me his number, said, call him. Everyone's getting married. Everyone's having children. He is still there. But it took a long time. It took being the father of a 10-year-old, which is the age I was when I met him. My younger daughter was 10. And meeting a high school teacher we both had who was really a mentor to us both. I was picking my daughter up from a play date, and the door opened, and there he was. He used to smoke in class, and he still had a pack of cigarettes and a book. He was a brilliant man. And the first thing he said was, "Have you seen Michael?" And this was years afterwards. And he said, "You should." And he said he would go with me. And so eventually I went.
What was that visit like?
Well, I had to call first and make sure that it was okay. And the social worker called me back and said, "It's fine. Are you the one who was hit by the motorcycle and went flying through the air?" And indeed, in right before junior high school, in summer of sixth grade, we were all playing football, and I was hit by a motorbike, which a kid was driving around and around and driving right at us. In Michael's memory, I had bravely taken on the motorbike, but really I was trying to get out of the way. But he somehow had been carrying this memory of me flying through the air. Anyway, he was remarkably similar and entirely different. He did not speak of killing Carrie because he didn't believe he had. At least when he was with me, he didn't. And so we talked about childhood. And he had, as always, perfect recall. He remembered the names of all four barbers at the Hair Fort, where we all got our hair cut, and the name of the pizza place and what the price of pizza was. And we went to sleepaway camp together, and he remembered all of the details from sleepaway camp. And so it was, in that sense, a very moving and strange and denatured experience, because we didn't speak about the one thing that was the reason he was there, but it was everywhere implicit. And in fact, Michael always carried a stack of books with him. In fifth grade, he would keep all these books on his desk, and he would read them all simultaneously. He had permission to read during class, so he would just pick up one, start reading, and then he would pick up another, like a chain smoker, but he would pick it up in the middle. One of the books he always carried around was the book Shane, which was made into a Western called Shane, classic Western. And I told him once that I'd watched the movie Shane with my daughters, and my younger one had fallen asleep. She was so bored. And he immediately said, "Oh, the book is better." And he started recounting the book. And it's about a gunslinger who decides to hang up his guns, and he goes and lives with a family of homesteaders. It's in the Wild West. But eventually, these homesteaders are being harassed by cattlemen who send someone to threaten them and eventually threatens to kill them. So Shane takes down his guns again, and he kills the bad guys. And he starts riding away, and the little boy runs after him and says, "You know, Shane, come back." And as Michael put it, Michael said to me, "You know, Shane wears a black hat like a villain, even though he's the hero." And then he says, in the book, Shane says, he can't go back because there's no going back from a killing. Was he communicating or embodying in some way, in the language of our childhood, some embodied recognition of why he was there? It would be an error to ascribe too much meaning. He was very ill, but there he was.
What have you told him about the book that you've written?
He knew that I was writing a book about our lives, but because it would have been wrong and cruel for me to say that I was writing a book about his killing Carrie, because he didn't think he had. And also, I didn't know Carrie, the woman he killed, but Carrie is in the book, and she is in the book as fully as anyone is in the book. And her friends were enormously helpful, generous, and it was very important to me. I wasn't telling Michael's story. I was, in a sense, telling my story, or my story of what it was like to be bound up with this story. And it was necessary for her to be there, because otherwise she would have disappeared, as she did, in a sense, even when she was the victim. It was his tragedy just as it had been his triumph. And so I had broken faith in that sense already with that single story. And that was part of the complexity, and probably why it also took me so long to write the book. And it begins with a little introduction. I am going back 50 years. When I started, I began, I am going back 40 years, and then more than 40 years. Finally, my wife said to me, "It's going to be 50 when it's published." and which was a shocking astonishment, because I was older than our parents were when we met. I could have been the father of both of us by then. Mm-hmm. But I begin that way because I didn't want to tell the story looking backwards only, filtered through what one of the professors described as a tragic inevitability, but to embody it and like a novel and tell it moving forward, overshadowed by an awareness of what would come, because choices were being made all the time, and it wasn't a tragic inevitability. Large choices were being made by the culture, by the legal profession, by the psychiatric profession. They turned into policies that reinforced the culture, that led to new laws that became bureaucracies that don't even have a mind. They just go like a doomsday machine implementing whatever their directive is. And so I felt I had to try to embody everyone, including Carrie, including our young selves. And so it was moving forward through a kind of ignorance. So it's very hard to explain to somebody whose relationship to reality is itself still broken, and were he to awaken from that state, would come to terms with the fact that he had killed the person he loved most in the world, especially because I was, as I say, telling stories, but also I had to untell them because so many false stories were told. And I had grown, just as we grew up believing being smart was all in all, we really grew up believing writers were everything. And it's like, it's not just that the victor tells the story, but that telling the story makes you a victor. But that is actually not the case.
I very much hope that you get the chance to go and see a kookaburra and a whole bunch of other birds, because what you've brought from yourself in this conversation and in the book is truly astonishing. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you all. Thank you.
Jonathan Rosen's book is The Best Minds, and that conversation was recorded at the recent Adelaide Writers' Week. And a big thanks to the ABC Tech Ops who made it possible, and also to Louise Adler for inviting conversations to Adelaide and making us so welcome. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.